Listening habits may have changed during the pandemic, but Charlotte Talks and the WFAE Newsroom are still making sure you're connected to what's happening in your community and beyond. But we can't do it without your financial support. That's why we need to hear from you during WFAE's September fundraising campaign. Call 704-549-9000 or go to WFAE.org.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We know that Russia waged a disinformation campaign during the 2016 presidential election. We also know they're at it again. What makes disinformation effective is that there is a kernel of truth to it. It's plausible. But when disinformation comes from a foreign source targeting our elections, it becomes a form of warfare that easily slips across borders, infiltrates the news cycle, and influences unsuspecting recipients to the detriment of our democracy. Despite the threat, the United States has done little to address this. We have left our response mostly to our social media platforms. Worse, we've turned this from what it should be, a threat to our national security, into a political issue. Nina Jankowicz is a Washington-based writer and analyst who studies the intersection of technology and democracy in Central and Eastern Europe. She currently serves as disinformation fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, whose writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, and elsewhere. And now she has written a book about the battle for the hearts and minds of Americans in her new tome, How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. And she joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Great to be with you.
You have, over the course of your career, provided strategic communications guidance to the Ukrainian foreign ministry. You've managed democracy assistance programs in Russia and Belarus. You write that during the 2016 campaign, while you were working in Ukraine, that it seemed that every day a Ukrainian was telling you that the United States ignored Eastern and Central Europe's struggles with disinformation at their own peril. The Russians have been at this in Eastern Europe and former Soviet states for decades, and yet you say this took the United States by surprise. Why?
Well, I think that, you know, we like to think that it was something happening in Russia's environs with former, you know, post-Soviet countries, and that we were protected against it, that we had, you know, a robust information ecosystem that couldn't be manipulated. And in reality, what happened, and this is something I detail in my book, is that Russia was trying out the same tools and tactics it used in the 2016 election in Central and Eastern Europe for basically more than a decade, since 2007 in Estonia. You could even look a few years earlier than that if you're looking at Russia itself. All of the same disinformation, the same social media-based manipulation was stuff that was happening in Central and Eastern Europe, and the United States turned a blind eye. I guess we didn't think that, you know, because we had an ocean separating us from Europe, that we were potentially going to fall victim to these attacks. Or perhaps we thought that Russia just didn't care to manipulate us anymore. But really, that's what makes this type of warfare, if you're going to call it that, so attractive to a state like Russia. The return on investment is very big, but the investment itself is so small, it doesn't cost very much.
And it is warfare. Could it also have been that we thought that they wouldn't dare do that to us because it's an act of war?
Well, I think there is some, you know, discussion about whether it is an act of war. And I, okay, even though it is in the title of my book, I personally... I fret about the securitization of this topic because, and I'm sure we'll get to this in our discussion, you know, really this is about people and their emotions and feelings. And when we, you know, leave it to our Department of Defense or the Department of State, make it a national security discussion only, we miss our own domestic vulnerabilities. But yeah, I think to some extent we thought, you know, Russia is on the downtrend. They're a regional power. Barack Obama very famously said that, which we know, you know, probably didn't make Putin very happy. And this is Russia's way of kind of leveling out the playing field, even though economically, militarily, even in the foreign policy realm, it doesn't hold as much sway as it used to.
We know that they interfered in the 2016 election, and 2 years after that election, I believe you were testifying in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee about preventing election interference in the future, and you say most senators didn't seem to get it. In fact, most of them left the room, except for the Republican chairman, Chuck Grassley, excuse me, and Democrat Amy Klobuchar. She stuck around. Mm-hmm. Understanding and combating this campaign would seem to be among the most critical issues that we face, particularly every 4 years. Why the disinterest and, in some cases, what appears to be willful ignorance? Why?
Well, I will give the senators a little bit of credit. You know, that day was also the day that President Trump was in North Korea with Kim Jong-un, but they've got busy schedules. They don't stay at hearings the entire time. That being said, yeah, I wish they had all stuck around to hear what I and the other witnesses had to say. And it's a message that I've been repeating for the past 4 years. And as my book came out this summer, I was really hoping that, you know, I wouldn't have to be beating the same drum. But unfortunately, this issue of disinformation, whether foreign or domestic, has become so politicized in the United States that even the most common sense regulations that are sitting in Congress right now have not been able to make it through. The things that would, for instance, make restrictions on political ads, the same ones that you have to deal with on the radio or that we see on TV and in print, they would apply to online advertisements as well. We still don't have a regulation that does that. That's the Honest Ads Act that Senator Klobuchar, the late John McCain, and Virginia Senator Mark Warner sponsored in 2017. It's sitting in what some congressional staffers have referred to me as the congressional election security graveyard, basically. And it has made it through the House, but Mitch McConnell won't give it a hearing in the Senate. And this isn't something that should be partisan. This is about protecting our discourse, making it transparent, no matter whether the information is coming from foreign entities or here in the United States. Voters have a right to understand who is advertising to them about political issues.
But this whole thing has become partisan, which really puzzles me. And I think it would puzzle anybody who woke up who may not be with us any longer. If you were Barry Goldwater, you would be very puzzled and troubled by the partisan nature of this. We kept hearing in the last election cycle that the Russians were interfering to benefit Donald Trump at the expense of Hillary Clinton, and that their desire continues to this day to help Donald Trump. That's what we keep hearing. Mm-hmm. It may not be true, but that's what we hear. We hear that China and Iran, to a certain degree, may be interfering or attempting to interfere to help Joe Biden to the detriment of Donald Trump. And yet politicians in Washington seem to be the only ones who seem to be concerned about this. Correct me if I'm wrong, are those on the Democratic side of the aisle. The Republicans are in la-la land. Why? This could affect them just as badly as it affects Democrats.
Yes, that's exactly the right point. And I think it's really important to underline that, you know, these foreign adversaries, the ones you've mentioned, Russia, China, Iran, you could even add Venezuela and North Korea, which have done their own influence operations, they're kind of unscrupulous when it comes to politics. It's not necessarily that they're going to support one party over the other in perpetuity. It's about whatever is going to benefit them in that election cycle. And it's also, in Russia's case, about creating discord and ultimately undermining our democracy, the functioning of our democracy, trust in our institutions in the long term. And that is not a partisan thing. That's just going to benefit Russia overall. I do think there are some Republicans who care about these issues. In fact, it may surprise you and your listeners that Lindsey Graham took over for John McCain on that co-sponsorship of the Honest Ads Act, and yet it still can't get through Congress. That is something that I think is, you know, created, that environment is created by President Trump, unfortunately, by his own politicization of the disinformation issue, calling the Russia investigation the Russia hoax, trying to point out, you know, that China apparently supports Joe Biden more than it supports him. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that intelligence assessment. Of course, you know, our intelligence community has access to different sources than I do. But from what I've seen from Chinese disinformation, especially as it's ramped up over the COVID-19 pandemic, it's about promoting a positive image of China. It's about denigrating the United States. And I don't think that is going to change, no matter who wins the election in November. And this is just very sad that, you know, it's not something that our politicians can all look at and say, that this is a problem no matter the vector that it's coming from, and it's a threat to our democracy. And we really need leadership from the top to be able to make that statement. And that's something we've not had. In all the case studies in my book, I look at, you know, countries like Estonia, Ukraine, Poland, the Republic of Georgia, all of these countries, if they don't have that recognition from the very top of their government that disinformation is a nonpartisan threat and a threat to democracy, then it doesn't matter how good their national security doctrine is. It doesn't matter if they recognize that Russia is a threat. There's going to be an incongruence in their policy, and they're not going to be able to fight disinformation no matter where it's coming from.
And we should point out that this disinformation is not just an attempt on the part of these foreign powers to elect candidate A or candidate B. It is to throw into the mix great distrust in the institutions of American democracy, which they've done in other parts of the world, which we'll talk about when we come back. Nina Jankowicz is a disinformation fellow. That's an odd title, Nina, at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and she's the author of How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about disinformation campaigns, those being waged by Russia and other bad actors around the world in an attempt to disrupt our democracy and influence our elections, with somebody who knows a lot about it, Nina Jankowicz. She is a disinformation fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She spent significant amounts of time in the Ukraine and certain parts of Eastern Europe helping to establish their democracy efforts. And she's written a book called How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. Since these Russian disinformation campaigns have been going on, Nina, forever in parts of Eastern Europe, are they using the same playbook when they interfere or attempt to interfere here, or are they inventing new ways to screw things up?
Yeah, it's actually very similar. You can track some of the tactics and tools as they've evolved from kind of the beta version in the early and late 2000s to what has been used here. And the most important thing for, I think, any listener or any American, frankly, to understand as we head toward the election is that this isn't about cut and dry fake news. You know, we often think, oh, it's a doctored photo or a fake news article. Actually, there's, as you said in the intro to the show, a kernel of truth to a lot of this stuff. And it uses the fissures in our society to kind of manipulate and exploit polarization and things like racism, economic inequality. So for instance, in Estonia, the Baltic nation of about 1.3 million people in 2007, Russia used fissures between ethnic Russians there who were left over after the fall of the Soviet Union and ethnic Estonians who obviously, you know, had a not too great relationship with the Russians and the former Soviet space as they became independent and integrated with the European Union and NATO. And Russians there really felt that they were second-class citizens. They didn't speak Estonian, so in many cases they weren't even citizens because they couldn't pass a citizenship test. They had fewer job opportunities, educational opportunities. They were even kind of de facto ghettoized in some ways. They lived in different parts of the big cities, different parts of the country. And the Kremlin used this in order, again, to drive those fissures between, you know, residents of the country. And this all came to a head. This will sound familiar to many Americans when the Estonian government decided to remove a statue to Soviet war dead. And Russia pumped, you know, Russian language media full of narratives about, again, capitalizing on those, the discontent of the ethnic Russian population. And it led to riots in the streets of the Estonian capital. There was also a cyber attack that brought down part of the Estonian government. So all of that should sound really familiar to the similar things that are going on here in the United States that Russia's been pushing since 2014.
Does that make it easy for our CIA and other intelligence apparatus to recognize that this is in fact coming from Russia, because it matches everything they've been doing over there that we've known about for years? Is that how we've been able to identify that among other ways?
Well, I think there are some similarities, of course, but the thing that makes it really difficult, and I think this is intentional on Russia's part, is that there are unwitting homegrown actors, or sometimes witting homegrown actors, who are involved in this stuff. So in the book, I talk about a protest group that did a lot of kind of interesting protests, flashy protests in the early Trump era. If you remember, there were people who handed out Russian flags at the Conservative Political Action Conference. They unfurled a resist banner at the Washington Nationals home opener in 2017. And also on July 4th, 2017, organized a protest outside of the White House where they sang parodies from the musical Les Miserables about impeaching President Trump. I remember seeing one of these ads. I do theater in my spare time. I saw one of these ads, and then a year later, in a criminal complaint related to the Russia investigation, it came out that the ads were supported by the Russian Internet Research Agency. And so it's really interesting because you never would have known that this was a partially Russian operation. In fact, the people who were organizing the protests didn't know they were being used by the Russians. And this is happening all the time. And that gives the Kremlin a little bit of plausible deniability. It also makes it really hard for the government or social media platforms or, you know, any American to suss out whether it's a Russian operation or not, because Russia isn't creating these narratives, right? They already exist in the society, and they're using authentic Americans to deliver them.
And because these are not just doctored, photoshopped pictures that they're inserting in certain things and some of the other things that you said, this misinformation is difficult sometimes to spot. You may be, as you said, unwittingly helping them because you don't see it as misinformation. So how do you define misinformation, and how can we spot it?
Sure. And I think it's interesting that you're using the term misinformation there. So this is a good learning moment for everybody. Disinformation is the use of false or misleading information with malign intent. So that's what the Kremlin is doing, maybe what China is doing, what certain political actors in the United States are doing right now. It doesn't have to be foreign. Misinformation is the spreading or use of false or misleading information without malign intent. So that's your crazy aunt or uncle at the Thanksgiving dinner table. And that's the key difference there, dis and mis. And then you have propaganda, and that's more like what the Soviet Union did. It's sort of like what China is doing now. In fact, I would categorize a lot of Chinese operations as propaganda because it's putting forth one worldview, one political ideology. That's not what Russia is doing right now. Russia, again, is happy to support both candidates on the left and right as long as it creates the chaos and discord and distrust in our system here. It's not scrupulous in terms of political support.
Is it? Well, let me ask you about that, because if the Russians are alleged to have wanted Donald Trump to be president, for whatever their reasons may be, whether they see him as a useful tool or they just didn't like Hillary Clinton, is it because of that? Because they really want that person A, to be in the office? Or is it simply because let's just throw some nuts and bolts and wrenches into the works and screw everything up for these people?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. So in the United States case, certainly a Donald Trump presidency is useful for Russia on a number of levels. Even though the Trump administration has instituted some harsh policies against Russia, what we've seen, again, is that incongruence that I was talking about a little bit before between what the Trump administration does, impose sanctions, you know, have harsh statements about election interference, and what President Trump himself says and does. He has joked on numerous occasions with Vladimir Putin about quote unquote fake news, right? So he's sending a different message about what he's willing to tolerate in the United States. And then, you know, there's also the fact that an unstable United States benefits Russia. When the United States is offending its allies, when the United States is calling into question the efficacy of NATO, when a United States president is calling into question question, as President Trump did as a candidate, whether Ukraine should be part of Russia or not, for instance. All of that benefits Russia. All of that doubt allows Vladimir Putin a seat at the negotiating table that he might not have had before. And, you know, the nations of the G8 kicked out Russia when it annexed Crimea, part of Ukraine. And yet a couple of months ago, President Trump was floating the idea that we should have Russia back to the G7, even though the status of Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, continues every day with Ukrainians dying almost every day. Russia has done nothing to change any of that. So again, I think this benefits Russia. That being said, it is counterintuitive that Russia is supporting candidates on both sides of the political spectrum. I often get people who are very angry at me on Twitter when I remind everyone that there are left-leaning movements and candidates that Russia has supported. In fact, during this year's primary, we learned from the intelligence community that once again, Russia was supporting Bernie Sanders' candidacy, because as much as it can defy the Democratic Party, that is benefiting, again, President Trump. It's creating discord within the U.S. populace, and all of that is really good for Russia.
Wow. Let's talk about how they're doing this. Mostly, we think about social media. That's how they're getting to us. I'm not sure that's the only way they're doing it, but you can tell us. And exactly, if they're using social media, aside from Facebook, which we know they've used, what platforms are they using to get this disinformation out?
Yeah. So not only are they using social media, there are also, you know, monetary levers of influence, which we've started to look at a little bit here in this country. You know, President Trump's business dealings, Russian investment in things like the NRA, for instance. That is something they use. They use fake organizations and experts to lend credence to their theories. They use cultural organizations, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe. That's a big vector of influence. So it's not just the online levers. But they are very adaptable when it comes to understanding how people are communicating here in the United States. So this year, we're seeing a lot less, I would say, influence on platforms like Twitter, where it's easy to create troll and bot campaigns using automated accounts, because the platforms have gotten pretty good at cracking down on that. And instead, the Russians have pivoted to using more private areas of messaging. So not only encrypted messengers like WhatsApp, which we've seen them use in places like Ukraine, but also Facebook groups. So Facebook basically adjusted its business model in 2018 after the Cambridge Analytica scandal in order to give people more confidence in the platform, that they, you know, thought they were dealing with their friends and family, that they were in trusted spaces. And they kind of promoted groups as places you could find your tribe. And because people are segmented by interest, that presents a perfect attack surface for any bad actor like Russia, or even domestic bad actors, again, because, you know, if you're in a group that is promoting anti-vaccination theories, let's just say, that makes you vulnerable to other conspiracy theories. And all Russia has to do there is drop a link in that group, and Facebook will prioritize engagement with it.
Could Russia be Q?
I think that's possible, but probably not likely. Okay. I think this is somebody with a good understanding of American politics. Now, that being said, Russia has supported the QAnon movement in its posts from the very beginning, which isn't surprising. They're going to latch on to anything that is a hot button issue, anything that's causing discord, and they're going to promote that. COVID-19, George Floyd protests, mail-in ballots, you name it.
With some justification, Congress put a lot of pressure on social media companies to get their act together and police their platforms and remove whatever disinformation they could find that they could identify as disinformation. But we put it really in the lap of Facebook and Instagram and other platforms to do this. Should they be the ones doing this? Should Congress be the ones doing this? Should Congress be passing rules and regulations, or does that put us in a very slippery slope, given our First Amendment situation in this country?
Well, I think we certainly can't trust the platforms to self-police, because it's not in their interest to basically undermine their own engagement, which drives their their profit. And that's why, you know, the groups thing that I was talking about before, right. Why Facebook has done very little to crack down on the activity that they're seeing in groups, because it drives engagement, it keeps people on the platform, and keeps eyeballs on ads. I think we definitely need some sort of regulation. I think the United States has abdicated its role as the headquarters of these companies and, you know, the leading democracy in the world, where we could set regulation for social media that is democratic and human rights based. Instead, what we've seen is patchwork regulation popping up around the globe, with countries like Singapore creating anti-fake news laws where the government can say this is fake news and slap a fine on anyone that, you know, it's unhappy is sharing some critical information. We don't want to see that. The United States shouldn't stand for that. And instead, you know, we've been hemming and hawing, and this issue has become incredibly politicized, and we've not done anything. So I think we need to do something. I'm hoping that in the next Congress, there will be political will to do something. We've seen some movement around this over the past couple of years. But what it should really be is, in my opinion, a really expert body, an apolitical body that is conducting oversight and transparency measures over the social media platforms, so we understand how those algorithms work, who they're targeting, whose, you know, information they're suppressing and why, making sure that everyone has an equitable voice. But we also need to understand, you know, what is driving these platforms, if they are, you know, prioritizing hate for profit, as has been, you know, a lot of discussion over the summer since the George Floyd protests. And we need some transparency around the ways that they're affecting political discourse in the United States and beyond.
I have about 30 seconds left. Even if we did police this, even if the social media platforms could do a terrific job of this, or we mandated it in some way by federal regulation, could we really do it? Or would we just be playing a superior game of whack-a-mole?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need a robust solution that isn't just social media regulation. That alone will not solve this problem.
Nita Jankowicz is our guest. She's the author of How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. And we will continue in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Nita Jankowicz this morning, a disinformation fellow with Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She has studied and worked with democracies all over the world, particularly in Eastern Europe, helping them to establish a foothold in the world of democracy, and has also witnessed firsthand all these disinformation campaigns. How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict is the name of her book. The Russians have been involved in trying to destabilize democracies, Western democracies, all over the place. We are told that they played a role in Brexit in Britain. They tried to influence the 2016 Dutch referendum on Ukraine's European Union Association Agreement, and more. Are other nations, who are obviously aware of this, taking a more aggressive stance against it than we are?
It depends. There are some nations like Estonia, which we talked about earlier, that have a very clear-eyed understanding of the threat Russia poses and have been taking whole-of-society solutions to addressing it. Not only, you know, sanctions and things like that, but also investing in healing the fissures in society that Russia manipulates. There are other nations like the Republic of Georgia, which has 20% of its territory occupied by Russia since 2008, and Poland, which of course has no love lost with Russia over many, many hundreds of years of history, that understand the Russian threat, but have a very similar situation to what we do in the United States, where the politicization of domestic disinformation undermines their, you know, counter disinformation activities against Russia. Unfortunately, you can't have it both ways. You can't say disinformation is bad from when it's coming from outside the borders, but it's okay when we do it, right? So it's a variety. And then, you know, you have the European Union, which sort of recognizes that disinformation is a threat, recognizes that Russia is perpetrating it, but isn't really putting the resources behind it that we would like to see. So they've got a fact-checking service in there, the equivalent of their foreign service at the EU, and they've only endowed it with 5 million euro for 1 year when they had parliamentary elections. And that's just a drop in the bucket when you compare it with what Russia is spending on a yearly basis on these campaigns, not only through things like the Internet Research Agency, but its intelligence agencies and criminal hackers that it works with and all this stuff. So really wide variety. I would say in Europe, you know, I think the UK is doing a good job, even though they did have issues with Brexit and this issue has become somewhat politicized. They've mounted a whole of government response where, for instance, when the Skripals were poisoned, the former Russian spy who had asylum in the UK, he was poisoned along with his daughter in 2018. Theresa May came right out and said, you know, we are naming Russia in this. They declassified a lot of intelligence. They pushed back actively on the Russian disinformation that was spreading against it. And I think we'd be unable to mount such a response here in the United States because of the politicization of this issue. So the UK is a good one, but it's really a mixed bag when it comes to pushing back against Russia.
So we know that Russia has individuals in Russia who are dedicated to spreading disinformation and planting seeds of disinformation all over the place. And they have a whole building dedicated to it, and probably others as well. But a lot of this is being spread by other people, people within this country, bad actors in this country. When they're acting in helping Russia spread this information, are they doing this knowing that they're spreading lies, or are they what we call, or what the spycraft industry calls, useful idiots in this practice?
Yeah, I don't really love the term useful idiots. Just because I think, especially in this era of polarization, if you tell someone they're a useful idiot, it's not like they're going to change their behavior. We need to approach this with a little more compassion. And I, especially with the way that Russia's toolkit works, exacerbating our pre-existing fissures in society, what we've seen more and more is people who really believe in the cause that they are, you know, organizing about. So like the Americans Take Action rally, the Les Mis thing I mentioned earlier, Black Lives Matter movement has also been targeted and infiltrated a little bit by Russia, as have groups on the right that are dealing with, interestingly, secessionist ideology in places like Texas and California, as well as gun rights activists. So they're all over the place. And these are people who are passionate about the issues that they're mobilizing against. And I think it's not that they're idiots. It's not like they are, you know, fellow travelers for Russia, but they are finding people who are expressing the same sentiments and perhaps not doing quite enough due diligence to ascertain whether they are, you know, authentic Americans who want to help them or not.
You say that to win this war against disinformation, governments must equip people with the tools they need to detect and resist what you call a pernicious form of online manipulation. Given the current understanding of this and the current state of our government, that's unlikely to happen. So, what kind of tools do we need? How can we equip ourselves to understand what's happening around us better and what's happening to us better?
Sure. So ahead of the election, I have been advocating for what I call informational distancing. And this came to me during the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic when we were first talking about social distancing. And there was a ton of disinformation and misinformation around the coronavirus flying around on the internet. There still is. The most important thing you can do is recognize that disinformation is manipulating your emotions. And when you feel yourself getting really emotional and you're so mad that you're going to click the share button, or perhaps you're joyful. I don't know if people can still feel joy during this day and age, but there you have it. If you're feeling a strong emotion, I encourage everyone to actually put your device down, close your laptop, walk away for a little bit before you share that. Introduce some friction and think about why this piece of information has made its way to you. If it's coming from a dubious outlet, try to do a little research about that. If it's coming from, you know, a political commentator, think about why they might be sharing it, what's in it for them. And then just, again, think before you share. The more that we can introduce that friction into the environment, the better. And it's not about necessarily looking for trolls and bots anymore, as we talked about before. It's about thinking about the motivations behind people trying to amplify potentially explosive narratives.
Emotions.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that emotions include fear. And you say that fear has turned off our informational filters. Fear is visceral. And sometimes we don't recognize fear as a motivator in ourselves, it seems to me. You are fearful, but you don't know that. You're just angry. So how do you combat that and bring rational judgment back into the equation when everything around us, it seems to be trying to divide us and make us fearful of the other?
Yeah, well, I think, again, introducing what the tech people will call friction into the environment is important, whether you're training yourself to do that or whether the companies are doing that by putting like an overlay on something that's been fact-checked and proven to be false or something like that. You know, I love this comparison to the fact that we get, you know, spam phone calls all the time asking for our social security numbers. We know to ignore those. We get emails from Nigerian princes promising us $1 million. We know to ignore those. We need to develop those same reflexes for the online era. And that's why, you know, you asked before, what can governments do? Obviously, this won't happen before the election and certainly won't even really have an effect in the next couple of years, even if we did it today. But we need to be investing more in people. We need to train voting age population to develop those reflexes that I just talked about, and kids as well, but that's the easy part. We already have the structure for that, right? We need to train adults, voting age adults, about how to navigate the online information environment, because so many people, particularly older people, are used to having those media gatekeepers telling them what's trustworthy and what's not. And they treat, and this is, I'm not just, you know, coming up with this on the top of my head. It's research that the Pew Research Center has done. They treat the information that's coming from social media with the same gravity that they treat stuff coming from mainstream media. So we need to develop that. I think we could use libraries to do that. They're looking for their raison d'etre in the 21st century and people still trust them. So we really need funding and the resources, both human and monetary, and the structures allocated by Congress, hopefully in our next Congress, to get that stuff done.
You're talking about a change in our society, and you write about this. You say that the real solution lies in crafting a society and a politics that are more responsive, credible, and just, and that requires listening to those who are susceptible to disinformation. This is a new thought. I'd not heard this before. You say don't mock them, don't write them off. You may find their views repugnant and the origins of those ideas are legit, but the origins of those ideas are legitimate and deserve to be considered. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, I think that from among the countries that have actually done a decent job or have at least started down the road to countering disinformation, they recognize that you need to look a little bit inward and say, what are these fissures that are being manipulated by our adversaries and how can we address them? Whether that's something like ethnic issues, which we talked about in Estonia, here it would be racism, right? Or economic issues, disparities in access to good employment, even things like, you know, geographic, geographic issues that allow people to kind of have a distaste for people on a different coast or in cities, things like that. Disparities is the word I was looking for. Thank you. Okay. Geographic disparity that, you know, drives tension. One thing, and I keep bringing up Estonia, but I just think it's such an interesting case study. The Estonian government, in order to let the Russian population know that they heard them, actually moved their presidential administration for a sabbatical from the capital to the Russian kind of enclave in Estonia for, you know, a month or a couple of weeks. Imagine if we did that for people in America's heartland, right? And we said, you know, here we are, we hear you, not just on a whistle-stop campaign tour, but here's the Department of, you know, whatever coming to see you, Department of Transportation, Department of Agriculture, or the president himself spending significant amounts of time in places that are not large cities.
But we're all revved up in this country, usually. One side hates the other. My idea is the only idea that counts. I'm right, you're automatically wrong. So what you're talking about seems to be something that would take a great deal of time. Do we have the time, and do we have the patience?
I think we have to. We don't have a choice, because the nations that are more resilient to disinformation, places like Finland and Sweden, obviously they're more homogeneous societies. They invest a little bit more in their citizens. They have a different structure of government, but they also have been doing this for many, many decades, investing in media literacy, understanding, you know, that the information environment is really important and needs to be protected, understanding that they need to hear their citizens and respond to their concerns. And I'd like to think that, you know, America, as the once shining city on a hill of democracy that we claimed ourselves to be, can also rise to that occasion. And it just means that we need to depoliticize this issue a little bit and be more responsive to the things that are causing these fissures in our society. I know it seems idealistic, but if we don't start now, then we are absolutely on a crash course to destruction.
Have these foreign actors who are trying to destabilize our democracy and influence our elections. And yesterday, the Washington Post reported on the Turning Point USA organization, which is a young conservative organization, putting teens to work at spreading disinformation. We have elected members of our government, more than a few of them, who seem willing to manufacture or disseminate alternative facts, as they have come to be known. I have about 10 seconds. Does that leave you optimistic? Can we get to this? Can we solve this?
It definitely worries me, especially that we are paying underage people to engage in essentially troll factory work. But again, I think with a change of mindset in the United States and a depoliticization of the issue of disinformation, we can get back to the truth.
Nita Jankowicz, our guest, disinformation fellow with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Her book is called How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. Thanks for spending the hour with us. I appreciate it. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.